KALW.
Our liberty is being infringed upon by the tyranny of bad design.
In our elections, we have to navigate the systems that allow us to vote, and they're different everywhere.
The U.S. runs its elections at a hyper-local level.
Today, we look at how our ballots are designed. Then, ranked choice voting isn't new, but many of us still don't totally get it.
You'd be asking yourself, if this candidate who I favor were not running in this race, who would I be voting for?
And we meet the people who work to ensure our elections run smoothly.
There's so much misinformation and distrust in the integrity of the election. It seemed like the best way to kind of combat that.
On the front lines of the election, that's coming up. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Tomorrow is Election Day. Everyone in California gets a mail-in ballot, and in-person early voting opened October 7th. As of last week, 5 million people had already cast their votes, but most people wait for Election Day. Today, we're not talking about what's on the ballot. Instead, we're going to look at the systems and designs behind the ballot. Drama around ballot casting isn't new. Many of us remember the presidential election of 2000 between Democrat Al Gore and Republican George W. Bush. Badly designed butterfly ballots in Palm Beach County, Florida, led to a weeks-long legal battle that wound its way up to the Supreme Court. Today, we're starting with an excerpt from the podcast 99% Invisible with Sam Greenspan and Roman Mars. It's all about the history of casting votes, how we ended up with so many different ballots, and none of them designed with voters in mind.
It's a poorly designed ballot. It is a ballot that does not take into account the way that a voter would look at the ballot and use the particular technology in place at the time, punch card technology, to cast their vote.
The ballot is a designed object that is critically important for democracy. But in the United States, it's almost never designed by an actual design professional.
And as such, our liberty is being infringed upon by the tyranny of bad design.
One of the oldest recorded instances of a vote is from the ancient Greek play, The Eumenides, by Aeschylus. In the story, Orestes is on trial for the murder of his mother.
12 jurors line up and take turns placing a stone in one urn to signify guilty or in another urn to signify not guilty. And this motif of the stone as a marker of a vote, it's an image that's stuck.
And the Greek word cephos, which means small stone or pebble, is the root of cephology, or the study of elections.
And as Eric Herron tells it, himself a cephologist, the whole stone in the urn setup was not too different than how elections in the United States were originally conducted.
So in the early U.S. elections, you will find voters casting a voice vote. They physically had to make their way to the polling place and announce their vote. And one of the things you do sacrifice is the privacy of your vote. Individuals know who you are voting for. And what that can engender is pressure on voters to support one candidate or another.
And the polls were not calm places with orderly lines. You could be badgered and pressured into voting a certain way.
Early elections in the United States often featured liquor and violence and fraud. Voters would have to push or shove or be physical to express their right to vote.
In fact, an election could be so raucous that
it served as an argument for some against women's suffrage. Elections were deemed as inappropriate for women to attend.
Then, in the late 1800s, election supervisors realized that having people vote by speaking their choices aloud was a terrible idea. The lack of privacy could lead to coercion, and those who did vote their conscience had no way to verify that their vote was being recorded accurately.
And this all led to the advent of the paper ballot, called a ticket. But unlike the ballots we have today, these were printed not by the government, but by political parties.
Political parties would print their own ballots that voters would take with them to the polling place. Now, these could be printed in newspapers, they could be printed by the parties themselves and distributed. And the voter would turn in that party ticket.
The party tickets would generally only have the candidates from that party on them. So if, say, you wanted mostly Republicans, you go get a Republican Party ticket, and then you cross out the candidates that you don't want, and then either write in or literally cut and paste pieces of paper with your candidates' names onto that ticket.
And this is the origin of the term to cast a split ticket or a straight ticket.
But this system also had problems. For one, parties could make tickets that looked like those of their opponents, but actually had their own candidates listed, duping voters into voting for the wrong party.
Non-standard ballots also created other opportunities for shenanigans, like racketeering schemes, which facilitated a whole black market of buying and selling votes. And so the party ticket system wasn't creating fair elections either.
So in the late 19th century, there is an innovation that is imported from abroad. It's called the Australian ballot. And the Australian ballot is a government-printed ballot that is distributed to voters who come to a polling place, and they cast their ballot in private.
And this Australian ballot system was a game changer.
First of all, we started treating ballots more like currency.
Administrators have to store them securely. They have to store them safely. They have to maintain a clear chain of custody over them to maintain the integrity of the election process. They're often printed on special paper to undermine counterfeiting or efforts to commit fraud.
And with the Australian ballot as a point of departure, polling places in the U.S. began to see new machines that interfaced with the official government-printed ballots. There were machines where you pull levers or use a metal rod to punch holes out of an optical scan ballot.
Like we saw with the butterfly ballot in Palm Beach County, Florida in the 2000 election.
Today, there is tremendous variation in how each county conducts its elections. If you move across a county line, your polling place could use an entirely different balloting system. Because here's the really crazy thing about elections in the U.S. Unlike much of Western Europe, Canada, and Australia, South Africa, India, and most other industrialized democracies, the U.S. runs its elections at a hyper-local level.
Because the U.S. decentralizes this whole process, you have a patchwork of election procedures all across the country. And it can vary at the county level or even within some counties as to how ballots are counted and processed.
We do this because that's what the Constitution tells us to do. It says that states shall conduct elections, and the states generally delegate elections down to municipal governments.
Partly because voters have so many things to vote for that each municipal government requires its own ballot.
We vote for so many public officials. Everything from president to drain commissioner can be on a ballot. Yeah, in Michigan. I grew up in Michigan. You can vote for county drain commissioner.
And so, given that each county is responsible for running its own elections, every county is on their own. They could hire a designer to make the ballots. They could not hire a designer to make the ballots. It all depends on what each elections official wants to do.
And that, more than malicious intent, may be how Grandma Jeannie and her ilk voted for the wrong guy in 2000.
Exactly. Pat Buchanan is a religious fundamentalist kind of guy, not the sort of person that a bunch of Jewish grannies are going to be voting for. If you had tested out this ballot in a kind of pilot test or run what we call a usability test, even with just a few people, that this issue would have surfaced pretty quickly.
That's Dana Chisnell. She's a user experience designer.
And I do applied research about design in voting in elections.
Dana, along with her colleague Whitney Quisenberry with the Center for Civic Design, have made it their mission to bring design theory and practice to elections.
In election administration, usability testing doesn't get done. Pilot testing on these kinds of designs doesn't get done.
So Dana co-authored a set of field guides to ensure voter intent.
Design manuals for elections officials.
And the very first one in the series was how to design usable ballots.
So one of our recommendations is use lowercase letters, use mixed case.
Mixed case print is just easier to read than all caps. This has actually been proven in studies.
We also say avoid centered type. Centered type is for wedding invitations and wine labels. It really doesn't belong on a form, especially one like this.
Other recommendations include using big enough type.
In New York, in 2012, I think, they used 6-point type on their ballots.
It's not uncommon to find magnifying glasses in New York voting booths.
The Center for Civic Design also recommends using one sans-serif font.
If you look at some of these ballots, they're kind of they look like ransom notes. There are lots of different type families that are used. The whole thing is just basically screaming at you. And we can calm all that down quite a bit by just going with one sans serif font.
The suggestions in the guidebooks for how to design a good ballot are akin to designing a good anything.
When designers get a hold of these things, they're like, this is design 101. Election officials don't know this.
And election officials, unlike normal clients, often have to uphold legislation requiring them to use bad design.
If you go look at election code in practically every state, design of the ballot is legislated. What the typeface is, what size it should be, what the grid is.
It's like bad design is legislated.
Oh, yeah. Almost exclusively bad design.
So not only do election officials have to apply better design principles to their ballot making, they also need to change laws.
But one thing that might solve ballots for good is standardizing them. It's actually a project which Dana Chisnell and the Center for Civic Design are also working on. They've developed a prototype called the Anywhere Ballot. It's a touchscreen system where you can resize text, adjust contrast, navigate easily, and verify that you voted for who you meant to vote for. And it's open source, so any elections official can use it. Though Dana is quick to admit that it probably won't eliminate all forms of unfairness.
Oh, well, something always goes wrong. I just hope that it will not be a major design disaster. The election official's prayer is, may the margins be wide.
May the margins be wide and the odds ever in your favor.
That was 99% Invisible host Roman Mars and producer Sam Greenspan in an episode about ballot design from 2018. Find a link to the whole story at kalw.org/crosscurrents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. Next, we're going to talk about a trend that's been gaining momentum in some places around the country, including here in the Bay. San Francisco, Oakland, Berkeley, Albany, San Leandro, they all have candidate races that use rank choice voting. San Francisco has been using it for the past 20 years, but it can still be confusing for voters. To learn more about how it all works, we're going to turn to our friends over at KALW's State of the Bay. Host Grace Wan recently spoke with San Francisco public policy reporter Laura Wenis.
So let's start with the basics. With ranked choice voting, I can rank up to a certain number of candidates. I put them in order, 1, 2, 3, etc. After I do that, then what happens?
So the way that it works is you choose your favorite candidate, like you just said, you put them in choice number one and so on. And when your ballot gets to the Department of Elections, they start tallying. And if nobody gets more than 50% in that first round of tallying, someone, the person with the least number of first choice votes, is eliminated. That person's second and third and so on choice votes are allocated. So there's the second choice votes of the people who chose the eliminated candidate as their first. They get allocated to the different candidates that remain. And that happens over and over and over again with more and more people getting eliminated until you have somebody who gets more than 50%. This is sometimes known as instant runoff voting, kind of because it does what a runoff election would do, except on the same ballot. So you would be asked, you'd be asking yourself, if this candidate who I favor were not running in this race, who would I be voting for? And that's how they tally it up and how you ultimately get to a winner.
Well, what problem is ranked choice voting trying to solve? I mentioned that it makes elections a little less expensive because you don't have to have these runoffs later on. But yeah. What other problems is it trying to solve?
So you mentioned this term strategic. And actually, one of the ideas behind ranked choice voting is that it helps voters choose more sincerely rather than strategically. So you often hear in, let's say, the presidential election of the United States, this idea of like, if you vote for a third party because a third party candidate is your actual genuine, sincere favorite, then you're just handing the election victory to the other person that you don't want to win. This mm-hmm. is a concept known as splitting the vote or mm-hmm. splintering the vote. And ranked choice voting helps to mitigate that effect, if not eliminate it entirely, because you can vote sincerely. You can put your first choice as, you know, somebody who may not have a huge chance of winning. Mm-hmm. And when they get eliminated, mm-hmm. you still have a say in what happens after that.
But we only go to ranked choice if somebody doesn't get 50% of the
That's
vote.
Right.
So if somebody gets 50% plus one, mm-hmm. we don't even have to get to ranked choice voting.
Yep.
Yeah, and in a contest where there are multiple candidates, sometimes it's unlikely that we will get 50% for that one person.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, so this is also a way to give people kind of a broader choice. And in theory, it's supposed to help or incentivize candidates to appeal to a broader base so that they have the support of people with like varying degrees of enthusiasm, and those people will still be counted. So if you're a candidate, you don't want to completely alienate the voters who might favor two other candidates more than you, because if those two are eliminated, you still want those voters to think that you're a viable choice. You mm. do not want to be somebody's anyone but that person vote.
But that can't happen.
It can happen that people strategize around this idea of like vote for anybody except for this one person. And we're seeing that emerge in San Francisco. Whether or not it will work is a different question, because mm-hmm. you need to give people, if you're a candidate, a reason to vote for you as well as some of your opponents.
Mm. I mean, it's possible, too, that we were talking about whether this is strategic or not, that mm-hmm. you can, as a candidate, say, I contain all multitudes. I appeal to all things. But then when you're in office, you don't really do that. Or maybe not, because you have ranked choice voting to look forward to, you know, in the next election.
You have to win in multiple ranked choice contests. Perhaps, yes. Mm-hmm. I think this is really the idea here is you want to encourage more people to enter the race rather than discourage people from entering the race, because you have like somebody who, you know, has a base of support but is widely unpopular, and somebody who is more popular but, you know, risks losing if somebody closer to their side enters the race and steals some of their votes or splits the majority support, and then you end up with something called a plurality election. If somebody doesn't have majority support but has more than the other guys, mm-hmm. You can end up with that person winning.
I think that most of the Bay Area races, well, is particularly in San Francisco, will be ranked choice. I've got the mayor, the city attorney, the DA, the public defender, sheriff, treasurer, assessor, and the board of supervisors. That's all ranked choice,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Voters are going to really have to do some homework here to figure out, even if the candidates don't have a strategy, voters are going to need to have a strategy going in, right?
Well, I will tell you this. If you're a San Francisco voter with a little bit of fatigue, you don't have to.
Oh.
Your vote is still counted even if you only rank one person.
Oh, that's nice to know.
Yes. And we in San Francisco are lucky enough to get up to 10 choices.
Ah.
That does not mean you get to vote 10 times. You cannot vote for the same person in choice 1 through 10.
Oh, I see.
Then if you do that, your vote will still be counted, but only in that first category. You don't get to vote multiple times in the same election. You essentially get to vote in multiple elections in one go.
So even though I get 10 choices, there are 13, let's talk the mayor's race. There
yep.
are 13 people running for mayor. Mm-hmm. I can rank 10 of the 13 candidates, mm-hmm. but I don't have to rank all 10, right? Yep. I could stop at 3. It just means that my ballot will stop being counted after the third person I ranked.
Yeah, you're essentially saying, okay, if none of these 3 make it in, I leave it up to the rest of you guys. Mm-hmm. You can decide without me. I don't want to do all this research. I can't rank them all in order.
That was San Francisco journalist Laura Wenis talking to KELW's State of the Bay host Grace Wan about ranked choice voting. We have a link to their whole conversation at kalw.org/crosscurrents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. In San Francisco, there are 501 polling places spread out across the city. And as with most elections, the city needs to recruit thousands of elections officials, poll workers, inspectors, clerks, trainers, and coordinators. Back in 2020, KLW spoke to some of them at Bill Graham Civic Auditorium. They shared their thoughts about working behind the scenes of that historic election. Here's a listen back to that time.
My name is Ebony Van, and I work for the Department of Elections. I'm the lead coordinator for the poll workers. So basically, I help with recruiting and staffing the polling places that we have here in San Francisco. It brings you back to what like a community really is, you know, and not only is it a job for me, but I also feel like when you look at it in a bigger perspective, we're all a community trying to work together. Like we have poll workers, they don't necessarily work here, but they're volunteering their time, you know, so we have to get back to that essence. I feel like that's really important.
My name is Michael B. Davis, poll inspector since the 2012 primary election. Something that I sometimes feel rather nostalgic about are the old voting machines. Has anybody ever seen them? Big, cumbersome machines. You pull down a lever for your vote. If you want to change your vote, you just flip that lever up and pulled another one down. And then when you were ready to record your vote, you pull down the red switch in the lower corner of the machine. One election, the ballot was so long that they had to split it between two machines, which meant they had only half the number of voting booths than they usually had. And at 10 o'clock at night, 2 hours after the polls closed, people were still lined up waiting to vote.
My name is Emily Anderson, and this election I'm volunteering as a poll inspector. I am a techie in this environment where there's so much like misinformation and distrust in the integrity of the election. It seemed like the best way to kind of combat that in a lot of ways. Like if someone I knew me and that I was a poll worker, it might like infuse a bit more trust in the process.
So my name is Benjamin Franklin Reed III. I lived here since 1985. So I've been volunteering with the Department of Elections for about 10, 15 years, something like that. I decided to get involved when I realized, I think at first, how many people just didn't vote. I'm looking forward to seeing people that otherwise don't come out to vote. I'm looking forward to seeing minorities of all different cultures coming out to vote. And I'm excited to see people have hope again, because I think we've lost it somewhere along the way.
My name is Max Tomaszewski. I think I applied for the job like over the summer. Didn't hear back for a while and then suddenly did. So it's kind of like an employment opportunity, mostly. I'm pretty surprised by like the fact that it's a lot of temporary employees, a lot of people who, like they're not like career bureaucrats or anything like that. Like it's like we all just kind of needed a job and jumped in and get it done.
Well, my name is Luis Mascarenas, and I've been an election worker for more than 20 years. One day I checked it out and I fell in love with it. I basically started in the warehouse, and it was basically lifting and receiving. So it was a process. Like I said, so much of ballots were coming, and we had truckloads of ballots and pallets of ballots. And I was wondering, like, wow, this is so much. So I was overwhelmed. But I like to lift, and at the same time, I'm a very fast learner.
So we're sitting in a room with like concrete floors, and there's shiny gold curtains everywhere, and there's like fancy lighting. I think they would have like banquets in here sometimes, but right now it's a bunch of metal carts with these large black bags that kind of look like suitcases. And every polling place supervisor or inspector picks up one of these bags to take on election day. My name is Madison Tam. I work for the Department of Elections. I'm one of the leads of the poll worker training division. This is my third election with the Department of Elections, and I'm a senior undergraduate student at the University of San Francisco. I mean, I've gotten to teach poll worker classes to everyone from high school students that are just interested in getting to know the voting process to 90-year-old women who said, I remember what it was like, you know, when my mom couldn't vote her whole life. My great-grandmother actually hosted her garage as a polling place for, I think, 30 or 40 years down in L.A. And she said, oh, it's so cool. I get to be nosy and see who in my neighborhood votes. I get to talk to people. I get to know my neighbors more. It was her favorite part of the year. And they always say that her and I kind of would have a lot in common if we ever were alive at the same time. And they said, she was the poll worker, and now you're the one who teaches the poll workers. It's some weird little spiritual connection going on there.
KALW's Angela Johnston produced that piece in 2020, and local photographer Annie Roddy took beautiful portraits of everyone you just heard. Hear the full story and see those pictures at kalw.org/crosscurrents. Today's Cross Currents team includes Yosmai Del Maso, Anthony Ivey, Aaron Lim, James Rowlands, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tense, Molly Blair Salier, Shirin Adil, Hanisha Herjani, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, Marissa Ortega Welch, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.